This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehayas Wuhib in Washington. And coming up on Africa News Tonight, hundreds demonstrate in Khartoum today. The UN is voicing alarm at surging arrests in Ethiopia. And U.S. Secretary of State and Kenya's President hold a joint press conference in Nairobi. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Kenya as part of efforts to pull Ethiopia back from the brink of civil war. The visit is the first stop on a three-country tour for Blinken, as Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Visiting U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta in Nairobi on Wednesday to discuss climate change, trade, the COVID-19 pandemic, and most urgently, regional security. At a news conference in Nairobi, Blinken said he and Kenyatta discussed the crisis in Ethiopia and the African effort to resolve it, led by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo.
Special Envoy Jeff Feltman is working with High Representative Obasanjo to press the parties to end hostilities immediately and without preconditions, to stop human rights abuses and violations, to provide humanitarian access for the millions in northern Ethiopia who are in dire need of life-saving supplies.
The Ethiopian government has been at war with the northern Tigray region for a year, and both sides are accused of committing widespread abuses against the population. Concern about the situation has grown in recent weeks as Tigrayan and allied forces threaten to march on the capital. On Sunday, Kenyatta visited Ethiopia, hoping to bridge the gap between the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government and Tigray regional leaders. Kenya's Foreign Minister, Rachel Omamo, said it is possible to find a solution to the crisis and said Ethiopians need to work hard on a peaceful resolution to the war.
We believe in the potential of Ethiopia to find a resolution to this crisis. We believe that a ceasefire is possible. We believe that the other conditions regarding humanitarian access are possible. We must believe in the fortitude and the wisdom of the Ethiopian people, because in the end, these solutions will come from them. What we must do as neighbors is to support.
Meanwhile, Blinken also touted U.S. help to Africa in battling the COVID-19 pandemic.
We've provided more than 50 million doses to 43 African countries to date, including indeed close to 4 million doses here in Kenya. We've also given more than $1.9 billion in COVID-related assistance across Africa to help meet health and humanitarian needs, including $76 million to Kenya. And we've done this with no political strings attached. This is about saving lives. That is the only metric that matters.
Secretary Blinken next travels to Nigeria and followed by a visit to Senegal. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Blinken is trying to advance diplomacy as a civil war would threaten the stability not only of a key U.S. partner on the continent, but all of East Africa. Ambassador Philip Carter, former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and Ambassador to both Guinea and the Ivory Coast, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi how significant the visit is for U.S. policy towards Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa.
I think Secretary Blinken's trip is absolutely critical. He's coming to visit a close partner, an African partner of ours in Kenya, at a time of significant concern and crisis in the Horn of Africa, specifically, as you mentioned, in Ethiopia, but elsewhere. And also, you know, with the Kenya on the Security Council, he's talking to a colleague, President Uhuru, to see together what's possible solutions can be derived to bring some kind of negotiated settlement to the crisis in Ethiopia. But overall, also to talk about broader issues that affect not just the Horn, but the entire continent, such as COVID-19, general questions of governance, security, things like that. It's a critical time.
Secretary Blinken called for a ceasefire in Ethiopia, the free movement of humanitarian assistance, and a negotiated political settlement. Could the U.S. do that by itself, or would it require help from Ethiopia's neighbors and the African Union, whose headquarters are in Addis Ababa?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the idea that, you know, one country can bring a solution to a crisis that's regional is not really a viable alternative. Obviously, we are going to continue to support and work with the efforts by the African Union, led by former Nigerian President Obasanjo, but also working with other partners. So it's a collective effort. It's an international effort. And the United States is working with our special envoy, Jeffrey Feltman, who's an incredibly experienced diplomat, working hand in glove with the African Union representative, President Obasanjo, and others to find some means by which we can encourage the Ethiopians to pull back from their fighting stance to find some common ground for a discussion and dialogue and hopefully a ceasefire long-term solution.
But some members of Ethiopian government have accused the United States of trying to topple Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and install a government led by Tigrayan officials. U.S. envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, called those claims false. How could such accusations negatively impact Secretary Blinken's efforts to reach a negotiated settlement for the Ethiopian conflict?
Well, first of all, anyone should consider those kind of comments and accusations as utter and absolute nonsense. And you have to ask yourself, why are such accusations being put forward? And it strikes me that there is an effort to set aside the discussions. And so I think, you know, in one sense, I think people need to set aside these ridiculous accusations and focus on the merits of what is trying to be achieved in terms of stopping further bloodshed, pulling back the troops so that people can talk to find common solutions to the problems that are confronting Ethiopia right now, which are significant. And so, yeah, does this have an impact? It may, but, you know, I think it is something that needs to be set aside as inconsequential to the fact that there are serious people trying to find serious solutions to a serious problem, and Secretary Blinken is amongst them.
The Biden administration pledged to connect its foreign policy to democracy and human rights. Was that pledge honored with the coup in Sudan and the other ones in Tunisia and Mali?
Our policy is to support democracy. The policy of the United States government has been to support democracy and human rights. It has been a policy that has been consistent for decades. Now, the actions and efforts by individuals, autocrats acting, or military leaders acting in Africa is something that poses a challenge to that effort, but does not change U.S. policy. And in fact, if you look at our reactions to the situation in Sudan, in Mali, in Guinea, and elsewhere, we are once again extolling the fact that a return to civilian leadership is absolutely critical, honoring the needs of the people of the societies and the governments and the people in those countries needs to be honored, and observing and respecting human rights so that the more important issues of social development and addressing some of the significant challenges in development and security that are confronting these countries be addressed. So our policy is consistent. The circumstances by which they're being applied change because of the circumstances on the ground. But, you know, the impact of the coups and stuff are not a consequence of U.S. policy. Our policy has been urging to change that direction away from coups and to civilian-led democratic government.
That was Ambassador Philip Carter, former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shenawi. According to the French news agency AFP, the United Nations is voicing alarm at surging arrests in Ethiopia since the country imposed a state of emergency on November 2nd. The UN Human Rights Agency says at least 1,000 people, mostly from the Tigray ethnic group, are believed to have been detained in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, the cities of Gondar, Bahar Dar, and other locations. Police have previously said the arrests are not ethnically motivated, but are aimed at detaining supporters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF. Government spokesman Legesse Tulu did not respond to a request for comment on the arrests. A number of UN staff are among the detainees. Through his spokesperson, Stéphane Dujarric, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for their immediate release, saying arbitrary arrests and detentions only serve to widen divisions and resentment between groups. Chanting no to military power, hundreds of demonstrators rallied in Sudan's capital Khartoum today in the latest protest against a coup last month. Reuters reports that mobile phone lines inside Sudan were cut ahead of today's planned anti-military protest. Mobile internet connections in Sudan have been suspended ever since the military took over on October 25th, despite a judge issuing several orders to restore them. Scientists are looking at the impact of COVID-19 on health services in Africa and how to prepare for the next pandemic while addressing routine health needs. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more on a virtual meeting yesterday by the African Society for Laboratory Medicine.
Africa has the largest burden of endemic diseases in the world and is home to a majority of the 10 million infectious disease deaths recorded globally every year. Dr. Pascal Ondoa is a director of science and new initiatives for the African Society of Laboratory Medicine based in Amsterdam. She says the lessons learned since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic should lead to the creation of better plans and investment for laboratory systems across the continent. She says Africa was better prepared for the pandemic than expected. So the COVID-19 pandemic has had less impact on the continent than other regions of the world. She says this was possible because African countries continue to regularly fight outbreaks including cholera, HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis. Ondoa says regional bodies such as the African Center for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and the West African Health Organization need to coordinate more effective responses to controlling and treating disease.
There's been a lot of coordination and collaboration between countries on the continent that helped each other to scale up the testing so that that was really good. The importance of the testing has been highlighted. The key component for outbreak response, there's been some collaboration between programs. So in order to quickly respond, we have quickly retooled some instrument, testing instrument, for example, that used to serve the HIV and the TB program, and we have used them to respond to the COVID-19.
Dr. Pascal Ondoa says there is also a need to scale up diagnostic services and make them accessible throughout Africa. Ondoa says one of the gaps that needs to be addressed is insufficient access of African countries to expensive medical products supplied by Western countries.
There has to be some thinking about how can we now produce some of those medical products, including the diagnostics, so that they are more easily accessible to African countries. I think also more involvement of African countries, local stakeholders, local organizations, local experts, when the agenda is being shaped and the funding is being decided, there need to be more contribution from Africans themselves to developing the agenda.
She says that infectious disease caused 50% of all deaths in Africa compared to only 2% of deaths recorded in Western countries.
So that really means that we have the largest burden in infectious disease, and some of the reasons can be some climate issues or a chronic lack of resources, there's a lack of capacity. So just to give you an example, in 2018, there were like 96 outbreaks of infectious disease epidemic that were reported to the WHO in the African region. The top three diseases that cause epidemics are the cholera, the measles, the yellow fever.
She says there should be more forums where countries can organize themselves to negotiate the price or production of diagnostics on the continent. The African Society for Laboratory Medicine is an independent international not-for-profit organization founded in 2011 that coordinates, galvanizes, and mobilizes relevant stakeholders at the local, national, and international levels to improve local access to world-class diagnostic services. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
South Africa's third biggest political party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, has dealt another blow to the ruling African National Congress by walking away from coalition talks with it. The ANC's poor showing in local government elections a few weeks ago means it has to form coalitions with smaller parties if it is to retain power in scores of municipalities, including key cities such as Johannesburg. The polls show the ANC falling below 50% of the vote for the first time since South Africa became a democracy in 1994. Darren Taylor reports.
All smaller political parties that got enough votes in hung cities and towns to potentially rescue the ANC from being deposed have now rejected partnerships with it.
War Council resolved to stop coalition discussions and negotiations with the ANC because they are failing to provide clear commitments and timelines on the key issues raised as the basis for negotiations.
At a news conference in Johannesburg yesterday, EFF leader Julius Malema repeated that his party was willing to work with the ANC if it agreed to put EFF officials in charge of some city and town councils and if it began a process to seize land owned by white South Africans. When the ANC didn't agree to these conditions, says Malema, talks collapsed and the EFF's now looking forward to defeating the ANC in national elections in 2024.
The EFF will not be voting for and will not support any candidate put forward by the ANC in all municipalities for all positions, including positions of speaker, chief whips and mayors.
Unless organizations such as the EFF go back on their word, the ANC is doomed to an unprecedented political failure. It will lose power in 5 cities and more than 60 towns. It doesn't have to come to this, says Good Governance Africa Director Richard Jurgens.
We're arguing that the logic of the results of the local elections indicates that a super coalition, as we call it, of the ANC and the DA would be the most appropriate thing.
The ANC and its chief opposition, the Democratic Alliance, the DA, are the 2 largest political formations in South Africa. But they've been bitter enemies for many years, with the DA often describing the ANC as an organized crime syndicate. The DA says it'll rather die than form any coalition with the ruling party. But Jurgens argues such partnerships may well be the only way to save citizens from service delivery meltdown. He says his group's governance index shows that of all the smaller parties, only the DA has the experience necessary to help the ANC develop cities and towns.
The top 10 municipalities, of them 9 are run by the DA, 1 by the ANC. The bottom 10, 9 by the ANC, 1 by the IFP. The ANC has hardly delivered services, and the DA has been able to, where it operates, although there are some complaints, that they're selective about where they deliver their services.
But the DA says it's not in the business of helping a party that's run South Africa into the ground. It's a long and idealistic shot, but Jurgens is part of a growing call from civil society for the ANC and the DA to put aside their differences and to live up to the Better Lives for All sloganeering both parties are so fond of. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Underscoring the need to bolster commerce, several heads of states attended the opening session of the 2nd Intra-African Trade Fair in Durban, South Africa. Exhibitors showcase their goods and take in dedicated sessions on trade and investment opportunities under the African Union's Africa Continental Free Trade Area Agreement. The agreement, which aims to make Africa the largest free trade area in the world, came into effect on the 1st of January. Vicky Stark reports.
The Secretary General of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area Secretariat, Wamkele Mene, said the fair is a platform to ensure there is contact and bridge building.
Business to business, government to business interaction, where the private sector will have an opportunity to improve its knowledge of the integrated market that we are presenting through the AFCFTA. The participants will be in a position, after having exhibited, to determine new market potential in other parts of the continent, to identify the main needs of the market in Africa, as well as niche markets that are most likely to be successful and to drive implementation of the AFCFTA. For the exhibiting companies, this trade fair is an opportunity for further interaction with buyers and sellers across the African continent.
Mene says by providing a large and attractive market with reduced cross-border barriers, Africans can now undertake larger investment projects on a continental scale rather than a national or regional scale, hereby positioning the continent for investor attractiveness, not only for intra-Africa investment, but for global investors.
In my view, the next wave of investment into African markets should focus on productive sectors of Africa's economy in order to drive the continent's industrial development in the decades to come. In recent economic history, very few previously developing countries have achieved high income status without a strong industrial development path. In this regard, the challenge for us will be to work together to ensure that the industrial development that we desire the AfCFTA to foster is inclusive of all countries in Africa, particularly those countries who today may not have the same industrial capacity as others.
Mene says the AfCFTA has the potential to unlock value chains for investors in key sectors such as pharmaceuticals, automobiles, agro-processing, and financial technology.
In the area of pharmaceuticals, in 2019 alone, our continent imported $15 billion worth of pharmaceutical products. This is an opportunity for us to leverage the AfCFTA, particularly in the area of intellectual property rights, to assert Africa's productive capacity and to ensure that our intellectual property rights are at the service of Africa's public health imperatives, as well as at the service of Africa's industrial development objectives. With the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, as we all know, less than 3% of Africans have been vaccinated. The key question that confronts us is how to reconfigure our intellectual property rights regime under the AfCFTA to boost Africa's capacity to manufacture vaccines, not only for this pandemic, but for future pandemics, and also to manufacture generic drugs to ensure public health in Africa.
While it was launched at the beginning of the year, much work remains to iron out the details of the free trade agreement. But Mene reminded those in attendance that it took the European Union 72 years to reach the level of market integration that it enjoys today.
We know from the experience of the European Union that the journey to market integration is difficult and that it takes time. However, I am encouraged by positive projections that by the year 2035, where we implement this agreement effectively, we stand a chance to contribute $450 billion to Africa's combined GDP, an opportunity to lift 100 million Africans out of abject and moderate poverty, particularly benefiting small medium enterprises and women in trade. These positive projections, of course, will not happen by chance. We as Africans will have to roll up our sleeves, work hard, and ensure that we overcome the challenges. I'm very positive about the prospects of the future of our continent based on the very first steps that we've taken to overcome the challenges of market fragmentation on our continent.
The Inter-African Trade Fair runs until the 21st of November. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suheep in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.